Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Let's talk about that line between popular music and classical music. I guess there are still some people who would like that line to be a wall, but for many of us, it's a smudged, zigzaggy, dotted line with lots of gaps in it. Here, I'll give you an example. This is the Brooklyn rock band, The National. And this is the Copenhagen Philharmonic, conducted by André de Ridder. Both of those pieces of music came from Bryce Dessner, who is both a rock guitarist and a classical composer. Bryce is part of a generation of musicians who work easily in both camps, and actually see them more as a single big camp. Now this is potentially good news for classical music, because it means a new generation of listeners is available, if the classical music world plays its cards right. Alan Gilbert, the conductor and music director of the New York Philharmonic, sees that opportunity and is launching a big and wide-ranging contemporary music festival here in New York. He'll join us in a bit to talk about the first ever NY Phil Biennial. We'll also hear the strange tale of an unexpected global hit that combined pop music with a style that actually predates classical music, namely Gregorian chant. It's the latest installment of our occasional series, That Was a Hit. But first, this music by guitarist and singer Sharon Van Etten comes from her 2012 album called Tramp. That record was produced by Aaron Dessner, Bryce's twin brother and fellow guitarist. Now, Sharon Van Etten is back with a new album called Are We There? And I've been looking at the track listing. It includes song titles like Our Love, Your Love Is Killing Me, and I Love You But I'm Lost. And my keen powers of deduction tell me that Sharon Van Etten's fourth record is about love, and maybe the end of it. We'll talk more about the album in a moment, but first, Sharon Van Etten and her band are here to play some of it live, starting with a song called Tarifa, live on Soundcheck. Something That is Sharon Van Etten and her band live on Soundcheck and a song called Tarifa. You'll find that on her latest album, her fourth, called Are We There, which comes out on Tuesday the 27th. We're getting to hear some of it live on Soundcheck today. And Tarifa, the name of the song, with Sharon Van Etten singing, playing guitar. She's also got a keyboard she'll be playing in a moment. Doug Keith also on guitar. Brad Cook playing bass, doing some backing vocals. Heather Woods Broderick playing keyboards and doing some backing vocals. Darren Jesse behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Sharon, good to see you again.
It's nice to see you too.
So have you been to Tarifa?
I have been to Tarifa. I wrote that song in Tarifa.
You wrote it in Tarifa. Okay, which is it's the southernmost point of Spain, isn't it?
Yes, it's my boyfriend came out to Spain when we played Primavera, and we rented a car and drove down the coast, and at that point I hadn't seen him in 6 months, so we just wanted to have quality time together, and we stayed in a solar-powered house on a cliff overlooking Morocco.
Right, so it's right across the Straits of Gibraltar from North Africa.
Exactly. We stayed in Gibraltar and stayed in a houseboat.
Wow. No song about that, though.
No, because it was actually really weird. That'd be a Weird Al song.
So the album, Are We There? I mean, is this a breakup album, essentially?
Well, it's deeper than that, because it really parallels trying to have a career and trying to have a relationship and trying to balance the two and the struggles that come with both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I was writing when I was writing it. You know, it's all very stream of conscious. So.
So at the end of the process, you look back and you think, oh, that's what this is.
No wonder people think I'm so down. It's just what I do.
Wow. So how long did it take? I mean, you know, Tramp came out, and then you were out on the road on your own. I saw you with the National at one point. I mean, you were all over the place. When did you get to write this?
While Heather was trying to sleep on tour, while I had a mini break, you know, a week or so at home, I just write all the time, but it was during the touring of Tramp I wrote it in the last 2 years.
Now, see, a lot of songwriters say they can't write on the road. For you, that doesn't seem to be so. Middle of the night, after a gig, you would wake Heather up and say, "I need you to play something. I'm working on a song."
Well, I was like, "Put in your earplugs or something. Put on your noise canceling headphones." And I'm really sorry. It's 4 a.m. and I'm writing. Your love is killing me. You know, it's just I've got. Sometimes I just have to.
Yeah. Do you? I mean, are you a fan in general of albums like, you know, Blood on the Tracks, the Bob Dylan breakup album, or Shoot Out the Lights, Richard?
Totally.
Yeah.
Come on, everyone loves a love song, even if like up or down. You know, that's the one thing that I think is like universal.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about an album called Are We There? I do notice the lack of a question mark. It's not Are We There? It's like Are We There?
I always have to have some kind of wink in a title because I'm a moron. And so, like, Because I Was in Love had a lowercase. Epic was a lowercase E. Tramp, I'm just making fun of myself, you know, from being a wanderer and mm-hmm. a woman. But then this was more of, you know, Are We There? Like, Are We There Yet? I also wanted to be open-ended. You know, Are We There? You think of a road trip. But Are We There is also a question I always ask myself, where I'm at, where I'm in my relationship with my friends, my family, who I am. And because it's open-ended, I thought a question mark would be distracting.
Yeah. Well, and for someone like you who has had so many roles in the music industry, I mean, Jonathan Myberg of Shearwater was talking about you tour managing him.
Yes.
Is that right? You
yes.
actually worked as a tour manager?
I was terrible, by the way. I was an awful, awful. I was a crash
Not
course
as he tells
in tour
it.
Managing. Jonathan, you liar.
And here, you know, you've not only written and sung and played on this album, but you co-produced it as well. You've done backing vocals. What was it like being a backing singer for Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds?
It was pretty unbelievable, and I felt very honored to do it. And I got to sing with my friend Shilpa Ray, who's based here too, and she's an old friend that I met when I first moved here, and it was nice to have a familiar face when you're doing something that intense.
Right. Shilpa's performed for us downstairs in the green space, as have you. Sharon Van Etten here with me on soundcheck. How difficult is the transition going from center stage, the spotlight, the big microphone, to one of the two or three that's off to the side and way in the back?
It was really amazing. I love that. Because I don't always want to perform my own songs. I like singing with other people. I like collaborating with other people. And also, even though it was for Nick Cave, it was really nice to just hang back and not be my thing. You know, I can hear harmonies all the time, and it's something I grew up with choir, so that comes naturally.
Did you grow up with country music at all?
Not until I moved to Tennessee. So until right after high school, I moved to Tennessee, and that was where I got educated in country, but not growing up.
Because, I mean, there are tracks on this new record that, I mean, they don't sound like country music, but they sound like someone who has some awareness of country music, especially the closing track. Called Every Time the Sun Comes Up. Now, the video for that is on the Soundcheck website.
Oh, thank you.
Soundcheck.org. It is definitely worth checking out. Did you have anything to do with the making of the video? We see an old guy putting on makeup, and it turns out he's like a late-night TV vampire horror film TV host. And things are just not going well for him.
Parallels my life. I have dear friends in Philly that do work for me sometimes. An old friend, Allison from Jersey, Allison Vocolo, she is a beautiful visual artist. And I'd asked her to help me with a video, but her friend ended up helping with a lyric video, and that went over so well that we asked them to do another one, and they came up with this idea, and I loved it.
Yeah, and the song really does have that kind of, you know, that kind of classic old country ballad, you know, I'm in trouble again kind of thing.
But it's funny because I originally meant it to be a Bruce Springsteen ballad. Like, I was calling it my Bruce Springsteen song, but it turned into an old kind of country kind of doo-wop mishmash.
One of the great tracks on the new record by Sharon Van Etten. The album's called Are We There? I think right now my favorite track from the record is the song you're going to do next for us called Taking Chances, which is like a real nice slow build. And you want to do that for us?
Sure thing. Anything for you.
Sharon Van Etten and her band live on Soundcheck today. They are at the Music Hall of Williamsburg on June 12th, and then two shows at the Bowery Ballroom on June 13th and 14th. All three of those shows are sold out. But you can hear them live now here in the Soundcheck studio. The album, Are We There? This song is called Taking Chances.
Turn on the shine.
Sharon Van Etten. The song is called Taking Chances, and that appears on her brand new album called Are We There? She and the band are playing live on Soundcheck and playing at the Music Hall of Williamsburg on June 12th, the Bowery Ballroom on June 13th and 14th. All three shows are sold out. We're going to move on to another song from the new record. This one is called Break Me. Once again, Sharon Van Etten and her band live on Soundcheck.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
Once again, Sharon Van Etten live on Soundcheck with the song called Break Me from the brand new album called Are We There? Sharon sang and played keyboards, Doug Keith on guitar, Brad Cook on bass, Heather Woods Broderick playing more keyboards and backing vocals, Darren Jesse behind the drum kit. The album is called Are We There? And Sharon, you mentioned Springsteen before and, you know, liking playing other people's songs. You actually recorded a version of his Drive All Night for the AV Club, right?
Yeah.
In the Stone Pony, the place.
In the Stone Pony, I got to play in Jersey. I had never been there before in my life. Always
to the Stone
to
Pony?
Go. Yeah, it just never happened.
So you'd never made that pilgrimage before.
I know, it's
to where it all began.
The shame.
Now, but you grew up in Jersey, right?
Yeah, born and raised.
So how important is Springsteen to a musician from New Jersey?
My mom still tells me stories about her coming down to the basement, because my mom and dad are vinyl collectors, and they came downstairs to the basement and just saw me as a little kid pumping my fist in the air to Born in the USA. It was just ingrained in me as a child, you know?
Uh-huh. So you picked a deep track, though, from his 1980 record, The River. Does that song have special significance for you?
Well, you know, again, it made sense with what I've been going through, with trying to figure out career and love and life and the idea of being in a car and driving forever to be there for somebody. I mean, it felt right.
So have you got all this figured out now? The love and the life and the career?
Never, never.
No, of course
I don't
not.
Know. I'm still figuring it out. But, you know, right now it's a good thing to focus on.
Yeah. So the album's out. Are We There is the new record from Sharon Van Etten. So that's going to be on some summer playlists for this year. But do you have a summer jam? Something that for you is just speaks of long car rides to the beach or vacation or whatever?
I think, well, any Neil Young record.
Really?
Definitely. I mean, it's just feel good. It's something I grew up with. It's a good go-to. But also if I'm in a dancing mode, I've been putting on this band Glass Candy that I really, really like. It's kind of minimal electronic, kind of post-punk, but pretty raw. But
Glass Candy.
Yeah, Johnny Jewel's the producer, and it's on Italians Do It Better, the label, and it's really fun to dance to.
Yeah. Love's in the air. Yeah, a woman, a winter, sun yummy inside. Well, Sharon, congratulations on the new record. Great to have you back with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's Sharon Van Etten's recommendation for a summer jam, the song Warm in the Winter by the band Glass Candy. Now here at Soundcheck, we're on a search for the greatest summer song ever for another of our Soundcheck playlists. And we need your help discovering all of those songs that are fit for the beach, barbecue, summer road trips. Give us your pick for the greatest summer song ever. Post it at soundcheck.org, tweet us at Soundcheck, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Coming up, conductor Alan Gilbert will be spending the summer bringing a contemporary music festival to New York. The music director of the New York Philharmonic stops by to tell us about the first ever NY Phil Biennial. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And I will freely admit that most New Yorkers, especially those of us who are native New Yorkers, think pretty highly of our city, especially when it comes to culture. Yes, a town like Venice has its big biannual art festival, but New York? Every day is a biennial here. But one native New Yorker apparently wasn't feeling quite so smug about the city's cultural offerings. Conductor Alan Gilbert, music director of the New York Philharmonic, is about to unleash an 11-day festival of contemporary music called the NY Phil Biennial. Alan Gilbert joins us here on Soundcheck. Good to see you.
Nice to see you. What a recommendation that is. Where do I start now?
Well, what were you seeing or maybe not seeing here in New York that made you think there was an opportunity?
You know, it's a very conscious ripoff from the world of visual arts.
Right.
You referred to the Venice Biennale. I think people are quite familiar with and comfortable with the idea that every couple of years you get together either in Venice or in Miami or Basel or wherever.
Or at the
York
Whitney.
Or at the
here,
Whitney. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of examples. And just take a look at what's been happening. I thought it could be really interesting as a premise for a contemporary music festival to try to do something similar, or at least create a musical analog.
Well, and the interesting thing about the visual arts, biennials in the visual arts, is they are focused on contemporary art, on what's happening now. And that seems to be, you know, there's always this kind of push and pull in music with, you know, getting people to come to contemporary music events.
Yeah, it seems, I don't know, I mean, you're very much in the contemporary music scene. I think, and I don't want to create any self-fulfilling prophecies, but somehow, and I'm wondering, maybe you have some ideas, if it's because of the time commitment that's necessary to experience a new work. If you're in a gallery and there's a piece of art that doesn't strike your fancy, if you're not immediately drawn to something, you walk by.
Right.
You decide how much time and energy you're going to spend. Short of walking out of a concert, essentially once you're there, you're committed to hanging out and listening to the piece for as long as it lasts. I don't know if that's the reason, or I don't know if it's that it's harder to own a piece of music. There's the kind of, you know, being able to have examples of visual art that you can collect or put on your wall. I'm not sure, but in short, I hope that it's possible to generate the same kind of openness and enthusiasm mm-hmm. about what we're doing in music, because I think it fully deserves it. And I think there are exciting trends going on, and we're trying to present that.
Well, you know, musicians from age 9 to 80-something, you know, being represented, it's not just the New York Philharmonic. Lots of other ensembles and musicians, composers, other conductors, all involved in the first ever New York Phil Biennial. Alan Gilbert is music director of the New York Philharmonic with me on Soundcheck. How long have the Bang on a Can folks been on your radar?
Well, they've been on my radar for a long time. You mentioned the collaborators. The Bang on a Can is one of the groups that we've enlisted to help us present this array of music. As I mentioned, music takes time both to perform but also to prepare. Mm. So very practically, not to mention philosophically, the idea of collaborating and making connections between different New York groups, organizations, and people is something important to me. But practically speaking, there's no way that the New York Philharmonic could do it alone. I think it's nice to show that, first of all, the New York Philharmonic can come to the party and dance with other things, but also to recognize the vibrancy of the scene, how you started out. I mean, it's incredible what's going on. And in a sense, we're filling a gap, but I also like really putting the New York Philharmonic forward as a focal point, a kind of nexus for the cultural dialogue.
Mm-hmm. So the biennial begins on May 28th, runs through June 7th, 21 concerts over 11 days in various venues. And one of the early ones features this music from Bang on a Can co-founder Julia Wolf. The performances are at Avery Fisher Hall on May 30th and 31st. And this is just a little bit of her piece called Anthracite Fields.
Oh,
just a little bit of Julia Wolf's piece called Anthracite Fields, a work that sort of looks back to her own roots in the mining towns of Pennsylvania. The Bang on a Can All-Stars featuring guitarist and singer Mark Stewart, and that piece is part of the first ever NY Phil Biennial from May 28th to June 7th. Alan Gilbert, the music director of the New York Phil, with me here on Soundcheck. That piece being performed May 30th and 31st at Avery Fisher Hall. You've been doing the Contact series for a number of seasons now with the New York Philharmonic. And one of the kind of big events you did at Contact was a piece by H.K. Gruber called Frankenstein, which was this riot of color on stage. And he is part of the biennial as well.
Yeah, I'm deep in rehearsals for his, I guess you call it, chamber opera, Gloria, a Pig Tale. It's whimsical, it's funny, it's about pigs, among other animals. But really, it's about us. It's about people, and it's about challenges and issues that we all potentially face in relationships and making choices in our lives. Gruber is a great musician, performer, and it's really unique what he comes up with. It's very jazzy often. Mm-hmm. It's definitely inspired by Kurt Weill and Cabaret. But what happens is it's just so incongruous in this piece, because you'll get, for example, a couple of cows who start jamming on this kind of doo-wop kind of doobie-doo kind of thing.
And is this going to be an event, the way when you did Ligeti's Le Grand Macabre, people who wouldn't normally go to a New York Phil concert went to see that because it was an event with a capital E?
Well, I hope so. It's the same creative team. It's Doug Fitch and his Giants or Small company who are creating the production. It's very charming and elegant and witty and funny and poignant what Doug has come up with. I think people will love it.
The piece is Gloria, a Pig Tale, and it's by the Austrian composer H.K. Gruber. It will be part of the New York Phil Biennial as well on May 29th and 30th and June 1st at the Met. Here's a little taste. Rambunctious little piece, isn't it? Gloria, a Pig Tale by H.K. Gruber. Alan Gilbert, the music director of the New York Philharmonic, is with me on Soundcheck on the eve of the first ever NY Phil Biennial, May 28th through June 7th. My thanks to Aspen Opera Theater for letting us play a little bit of their performance of it. Here in New York, it's May 29, 30, and June 1st at the Met. It is, at heart, a piece about expectation and living up to the weight of expectation. What about for you as the music director of the New York Philharmonic? You know, is this biennial a way of kind of maybe changing expectations, subverting the expectations of that role?
Well, I guess to an extent, I hope so. You know, it's admittedly cheeky to call the first iteration of an event a biennial.
You are promising
we're committing ourselves in a sense to, yeah, you know, the first thing we had to discuss after we decided to call it a biennial is how often we would be doing it. We settled on every 2 years, and the point is that we want to create something that will continue to exist, obviously in a different form. It's supposed to be current, so the next one will be current 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. It's not just the New York Philharmonic, but I think other such venerable, important, large cultural organizations can sometimes fall into the trap of you know, the ivory tower syndrome. And so I very consciously, not only in this, but in other things we've done, have tried to reach out to other institutions and other organizations in the city. And this was a perfect, I mean, as I said, we needed to do it because we couldn't possibly do it ourselves. But to me, that's very important. And it does put the New York Philharmonic in the center of that cultural dialogue I spoke of in a way that I think is appropriate.
So does that, I mean, what does this say about the future of the orchestra? Is it important for the orchestra in the 21st century to be able to, you know, scale down to a chamber size ensemble and play at a place like Subculture, as you're doing in this festival?
I think orchestras have become so much more than concert generating machines, if you will. It's a bad word, but you see what I'm saying. Just a kind of mechanism for presenting concerts. We've taken to talking about and thinking about the New York Philharmonic as a resource. The New York Philharmonic is so flexible and so nimble. When we pare down and become a lean, mean contemporary music ensemble, there's no better.
There you should use machine. A lean, mean contemporary music machine.
Yeah, that's what we can be. And we can do a lot of things. And the ability to be flexible and reactive and use the capacity that is quite unique to the New York Philharmonic. I think that's what the modern orchestra is going to be about. It happened that a lot of the changes happened through necessity.
Right.
There was a trend away from public education, music education in public schools, less funding. So orchestras started picking up the slack. That became an area in which it was possible to get grant money. I think we're in the second phase of that shift now, and it's not only because of necessity. It's the new paradigm for what orchestras are. And we're trying to be able to cover a wide range of areas and activities. Of course, contemporary music is one of them.
So presenting not only your own concerts, but concerts by other ensembles, and this is a very collaborative festival, this first ever biennial. In fact, on the same program as the Julia Wolf piece that we heard earlier, the biennial is presenting Dream House, which is a kind of a opera of sorts by the electric guitarist and Princeton University professor and composer Steve Mackey. And, you know, for folks who think contemporary music is all gnarly and difficult, here's a piece that ends with a kind of a hit tune. Giving too much away, I will say that whole line about I'll build you a dream house where you can live, where you'll be safe, is sung ironically in the context of the story of Dream House by Stephen Mackey, also being performed at Avery Fisher Hall on May 30th and 31st as part of the first New York Phil Biennial. May 28th through June 7th, 21 concerts, 11 days, many different venues. Alan Gilbert, music director of the New York Philharmonic, with me here on Soundcheck. And New York does have right now, Alan, especially in places like Brooklyn and the Lower East Side, a community of classical musicians who are also maybe classical composers who are completely fluent in and often play in rock bands as well. So, you know, there's like a generation now of younger people for whom that distinction between rock music and contemporary classical is getting kind of blurry. Is that an opportunity that you guys have sort of noticed and decided to go after.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a distinction without a difference. And it's an easy way to say it, but I happen to think it really has meaning, you know, what Duke Ellington said about there only being two kinds of music.
Good kind and bad kind.
And the other kind. And the other kind. Yeah, it's arbitrary. I mean, of course, the New York Philharmonic will always play Brahms as well as it possibly can. But, you know, putting different genres together, putting different types of music together, even different size ensembles. I mean, there's so many practical considerations that can militate against integration. We're trying to transcend those. And if this festival, this biennial, can be a very pure and optimistic example, expression of that, then, wow, so much the better.
And as you say, also a snapshot of where we are in New York in 2014.
There we are.
All right. Alan Gilbert, the music director of the New York Philharmonic and the brains behind this operation. The NY Phil Biennial opens on May 28th, runs through June 7th, and you can find the complete listings on the New York Phil website. There is a special page just for the biennial. Alan, a great pleasure seeing you again. Thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure for me, as always. Thanks.
Up next, the song that combined dance beats, sexy vocals, and Gregorian chant. It's another edition of our series, That Was a Hit, coming up on Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time now for another installment of That Was a Hit, Soundcheck's look at puzzling chart success. And today we are joined again by our frequent guest, Chris Melanfi. And today, Chris, we're going to talk about this song that we're hearing beneath us from our regular That Was a Hit opening montage.
That's right, yep. It's Sadness or Sodness, part one. That part one is an important detail. Sadness Part One by Enigma.
Now, it is spelled S-A-D-E, as in the Marquis de Sade.
That is correct,
so,
yes.
Although in England, I think it was released without the E, so it looked like Sadness.
Yeah, and a lot of people pronounced it Sadness, but I suppose if you're being very specific, you should say Sodness.
So who or what is Enigma?
Okay, Enigma is the musical project. They're not a group per se. The musical project of a Romanian-born, Germany-based gentleman named Michael Cretu, C-R-E-T-U. He has kind of been in and around the German music industry for decades, long before he had this hit. As far back as the 70s, he crossed paths with German music mastermind Frank Farian. If you've ever heard that name, he's behind two mega pop groups, one in the 70s, Boney M., who had a number of international hits, including a couple in the U.S., and then he became quite infamous as the mastermind behind Milli Vanilli in the 90s. Michael Cretu played keyboards a little bit during the Boney M. days, and that helped get his start.
All right, so Michael Cretu, Romanian-born, German-based, he comes up with this collision of Gregorian chant and new wave electronics and dance beats, and how big a hit does he end up with?
He ends up with an international number one hit that also made it to number five on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. This thing just exploded. It was kind of a brainstorm that he had. He became a producer in the late 80s, and one of the acts he produced was this German singer named Sandra, who did a cover of Everlasting Love. We all know this song. We've all heard it, Everlasting Love. And he led that recording off with a very faint Gregorian chant. You can barely hear it. It's in the mix in the first 10 seconds of the song. And it kind of gave him the idea, well, what if I took that idea and went further? What if I did a whole album pairing pre-existing Gregorian chants with sort of dance beats and new agey elements and vaguely mystical themes and, you know, just kind of did a whole album that paired these old sounds with these dance beats? And he had, you know, all of these vaguely gothic titles like Mea Culpa and The Rivers of Belief. And then, of course, the centerpiece was Sadness, which by the way, was part of the reason he had to call the single Sadness Part 1 is because on the album, it is part of an 11-minute suite called The Principles of Lust.
Yeah.
And
so in addition to the sampled Gregorian chant, there's a breathy French female voice.
Yep. Saying, sad, dis-moi, sad, donne-moi.
Tell me, give me.
Exactly. Yeah. In a rather orgasmic voice.
Yeah, so it's a little porny in addition to all the mysticism and stuff. It was a global hit back in 1990 for Enigma. It is such a bizarre mashup of like religious prayer, thousand-year-old chant with this very kind of sexy, whispery vocals and stuff. Chris Malanfi is a pop chart analyst, contributor to NPR Music and Slate, and our frequent guest on our That Was a Hit series about surprising, even puzzling chart success. And on Soundcheck today, we're finally talking about Sadness, or Sadness, depending on how you want to pronounce it, the 1990 song by Enigma that is part of our regular opening montage when we do That Was a Hit. The flute sound, that's a Japanese shakuhachi flute, also sampled.
Right.
Which he seems not to have gotten in trouble for.
No, that may be one of the few things he did get in trouble
for. But everything else he got in trouble. I mean, you know, he didn't clear the rights for the Gregorian chant.
No.
Lost a lawsuit.
Let's also remember that this is 1990. There hasn't been a ruling on sampling yet, right? The Bismarck Key case in 1991 hasn't happened yet. So it's still the Wild West days of, you know, borrowing whatever you want.
And yet, you know, the German group, the Capella Antiqua, that he sampled.
Right.
They eventually came after him and got a settlement.
Understandably. I mean, a global hit like that, my goodness.
Yeah. And there's a little fragment from the Hilliard Ensemble, which they told us here in the studio many years ago. They had to, like, listen really, really closely.
Because it's just buried in the mix.
Had been pitch shifted.
Sure.
And they went after them, too, and got a settlement. So.
I mean, this guy has had only a couple of hits, but, like, he had to eventually settle with virtually everybody who was involved with any piece of it.
And in so doing, this guy, Michael Cretu, the guy behind Enigma, set off a kind of chain reaction of pop hits.
He did.
For Gregorian chant.
Yeah. I mean, that's the crazy thing. I mean, first of all, what's kind of nuts about Sadness itself is that in addition to being a hit single, it sold a truckload of albums. This album kind of became the Tubular Bells of its day. It sold for years. It was on the Billboard charts here in America for 5 years. I'm not exaggerating.
Wow.
You know, you can gather that people heard the song and thought, gee, I think I want an hour of that. And then, as if all that wasn't enough, it spawned a fad where in 1994, an unrelated album by a group of 36 monks living in an 8th century monastery in north central Spain who called themselves the Benedictine Monks of Santo Domingo de Silos, they released an album called Chant. It reached number 3 on the Billboard 200 album chart, and it ultimately went double platinum.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this became a phenomenon.
And spawned a kind of renaissance of chant music in the middle of the 1990s, including this. If you were waiting for the drum beats, the synthesizers, the sampled flute, not going to happen. The Benedictine monks of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain had a couple of hit records with plain old Gregorian chant.
Exactly.
In the wake of this Enigma song.
Right. It's like people went back and they wanted the uncut stuff.
Multiple millions of these albums sold.
Yes.
So do we look back at Enigma and that song, Sadness, from 1990, and do we say, one-hit wonder, here today, gone tomorrow?
I mean, yes and no. First of all, he's not a one-hit wonder. It wasn't even his biggest or last hit. A couple years later, in 1994, he released a sequel album called Enigma 2, The Cross of Changes. It went double platinum. It spawned a number four hit. It actually went a notch higher on the charts, called Return to Innocence. Yet again, he got himself in trouble because he sampled Taiwanese chanting that was taken from a pre-existing recording and sampled without permission. Again, he had to settle afterward. He still records as Enigma and does pretty well for himself. That Enigma record is a perennial seller. For a time, it was even one of Virgin Records' all-time best-selling albums.
The album was called MCMCXAD.
That's right, which just means in Roman numerals 1990. But it looked good and gothic on the cover.
It really did. And that hit, Sadness by Enigma, was everywhere in 1990. Yes, that was a hit. Chris Melanfi, once again, good to have you here.
Anytime, John.
If you like this exploration of sadness, make sure to check out our archive for podcasts of That Was a Hit. They're all over at soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, each installment of the 33 and a Third book series is about a classic album. The latest installment was inspired by the 2001 record I Get Wet, by party rock maestro Andrew W.K. Tomorrow, the author of the book, Philip Crandall, joins the subject of the book, Andrew W.K., for a conversation in our studio. Plus, what data from Billboard and Spotify can tell us about summer jams. And remember, we want you to give us your pick for the greatest summer song of all time. Post it at soundcheck.org, tweet us at soundcheck, or leave a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.